who's made mention of Jana and the family. We're all doing well. We're glad to be back. John 11. Let's get started with a word of prayer. Jonathan, would you lead us in a word of prayer to get started? Amen. Okay, John 11 is certainly an important passage, important chapter. Rather than us try to do a verse-by-verse examination of the text, I'm going to approach it somewhat thematically. And I think it has a lot of power when you approach it that way, and certainly we'll be looking at sections of it, and if you have questions or things you'd like to add to our discussion, we'll certainly allow you to do that. But I'm going to try to steer our thinking in a particular direction this evening. When we look in the Gospel of John, throughout this, there have been claims to life. Jesus being the life. And of course, when we begin in John 1 and verse 4, in Him was life, and the life was a light of men. And you may remember, there are ways throughout the book which Jesus Himself emphasizes that. Can you think of some of those? How does Jesus emphasize this acclamation of Him that He is the life? Mary? Go on. Okay, so yes, in John chapter 6, I am the bread of life. Eat me, eat my flesh. Okay, that's one way. What other way? Okay, living water. So actually those are the first two. Whether you're looking at His discussion with the woman at the well in chapter 4, or His discussions there in chapter 7 in Jerusalem, where He beckons people to drink from Him, that He has, He is, the water of life. And then in chapter 6, He is the bread of life. There's also a note in the discussion on Sunday in chapter 10 where Jesus makes a very emphatic point about the life that He offers. What does He say in John 10 and verse 10? John 10, verse 10. Okay, so His sheep. If He is the shepherd and He is the door for His sheep, then His sheep are going to have life, and they're going to have life abundantly. So you kind of see again this strain throughout the book that you begin with saying in Him was life, and then Jesus claiming Himself in various places and in various ways to be life. I am the water of life. I am the bread of life. I give life abundantly to my sheep. What's John 11 about? Or what is the central event in John 11? A death has occurred. And what John 11 focuses on is how do Jesus' claims to being life, well, how do they stand in the face of death? And I think that's kind of where this is all leading to, and the point that John 11 is getting over to us. Now, Jesus already in the book of John has made rather outstanding claims about His power over death. It's in chapter 5. Do you remember what Jesus said in chapter 5 about His power over those who are already dead? I think I heard something over here. All right, chapter 5, and let's look at verses 28 and 29. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming in which all who are in the tombs will hear His voice and will come forth. Those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life, those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment. So Jesus, again, has already made this claim. There's going to be a day when all hear my voice, and they're all going to come forth from the grave. Now we'll even see in John chapter 11... Martha has no problem believing in a future resurrection, that Lazarus will be raised in the end. Maybe her understanding is that of the Pharisees and that of Judaism, or maybe she is just aware of what Jesus had said here, and she believes that someday, at the end, all are going to be raised from the dead. But Jesus will go further in John chapter 11 to assert the true power he has over death. And perhaps the key verse in the entire, key passage rather than the entire chapter, in verses 25 and 26, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? So here is Jesus saying, life is found in me. If you believe in me, even if you die, you will live. And if you believe in me, you will never die. And of course, in keeping with the rest of the book, there's a physical aspect to that, you may say. But there's a spiritual aspect to that, which is certainly true. True life being found in Jesus, the absence of death, and of course, future life, even with a resurrection from the grave. All contingent on what? What's it contingent on? Believing. Okay, so this, again, another theme is found throughout the book. Those who believe in Him. And Jesus is saying, the life that I am offering is for those who believe in me. So it's no surprise that one of the outstanding features in John chapter 11 is you encounter a lot of unbelief, or a lot of doubt, a lot of failure to appreciate all that Jesus is. So let's talk about that here in John chapter 11. Let's begin with the disciples. And again, we're not going to take time to read all of this, but in just giving the basics of the story, at the end of chapter 10, it says that because of the deteriorating conditions in the relationship of Jesus and the Jewish leaders, they are now constantly seeking to apprehend him. So he removes himself from Jerusalem. He had been in Jerusalem for quite a bit of those previous chapters. He removes himself from Jerusalem, and it talks about he goes beyond the river to the area where John had been baptizing. Well, the only other key we have for that is in the first chapter when John was baptizing at Bethany. Now, that is very far in the north. It may be that Jesus went all the way there, and by the time he gets to John chapter 11, is closer to Jerusalem. It may be that he didn't actually ever go all the way back up to Bethany, that he was at another place where John had been baptizing. I don't have a concrete answer for you on that. But he is beyond the Jordan River. And so he's in an area now which is not heavily, at least too heavily influenced by the Jewish leadership. And his disciples even believe that where they are now at least offers them some safety. Well, of course, he received word from Mary and Martha that Lazarus, whom he loved, had died. Now, these figures are not introduced to us in the book of John until now. We know them from other gospel accounts, though. They are from the city of Bethany. And Bethany, as we'll read even later in the text, is only not even 2 miles away from Jerusalem. And of course, the call is for Jesus to return. You know, Lazarus is sick. Now, those of you who have read the text, if Jesus had picked up and left at that moment, would he have made it back in time to cure Lazarus of his ailment? Would not seem that he would. He's going to tarry or delay 2 days, but by the time he gets back to where Lazarus is, he's already been dead for 4 days. So this may just be an occasion where he is very sick when the messengers depart, and he may have even died before the messengers got to Jesus. But the whole thing is, how do the disciples respond to Jesus' words after these 2 days of delay, and Jesus now says, let's depart and go to Judea? What do the disciples say? Look at verse... That's right. Rabbi, verse 8, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? And then you go further in the text, and Thomas, who was called Didymus, or the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go so that we may die with him. There's not a lot of faith here that Jesus is going to be able to go and do anything. In fact, their only concern is that Jesus is going to go and he's going to die and we're going to go and we're going to die with him. So actually, in this passage, Jesus is trying to bolster their faith some. Notice what he said in verse 4. This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so the Son of God may be glorified by it. Think about that statement for a minute. And we've talked about this in other passages. You know, did God cause the man who was born blind to be blind so that God's glory could be revealed? Did God cause Lazarus to die? No, but in Jesus' handling of these issues, the glory of God is revealed. And certainly the glory of God is going to be revealed in Jesus when he goes and he raises Lazarus from the dead. So he's telling his disciples, this sickness is not going to end in death. He's going to die. But what it's going to result in is God is going to be glorified. And God is glorified because the Son is glorified. He also talks about in verse 9, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. Jesus is relatively late in his ministry. And you think about a work day, and from that standpoint, Jesus is actually very late in that work day. 12 hours is almost up. Does Jesus stop working? Does he stop glorifying the Father by his actions? No, he's given this task. He's going to glorify God. He's going to continue to do that. And then, of course, there's an interesting wording in verse 11. You'll note he said, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. Plural, our friend. He did not say, we go to awaken him, did he? I go to awaken him. Only Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Only Jesus is going to be able to go and actually do anything about this issue. And of course, there, you know, much of this is self-explanatory. As you read the text, they're confused. Well, if he's asleep, then you know he's going to get better. No, he's dead. But Jesus' point is, I am going to awaken him. There's nothing indicating in this text, though, that the disciples believed that that was possible and that it would result in anything other than Jesus losing his life. Any questions, comments on the first 16 verses? Again, I'm going a little thematic, but if you do have a question about the text you're confused about, please bring that up and we'll see if we can find an answer. Okay. So the disciples are struggling to believe. What about Martha? Look at some of her statements. Okay, so now you go further. They now made their way to Bethany. And it is Martha who's the first to go and talk with Jesus. And what does she say out of the gate? Read for me, somebody, if you would, verses 21 and 22. Okay. Mary is going to have the same statement of faith, at least that first verse. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Now, I don't think there's any accusation there about Jesus delaying. Again, it would seem from the text, if Jesus had come as soon as the messengers got to him, Lazarus would have been dead. Just an affirmation of faith, Lord, if you had been here, he wouldn't have died. Now, the next verse would maybe seem to indicate that she believed Jesus is going to be able to do something even now. But the rest of the chapter would say, no, that's not what Martha's thinking. She's just saying that I know God hears you. And I still have this faith in you that when you talk to God, God does hear you. So there is faith here. But Jesus says your brother is going to rise again. Lazarus is going to rise again. And how does Martha respond? Okay, the resurrection. The resurrection at the end, I know my brother is going to respond, or going to rise. And it's in that context, as Jesus said in verses 25 and 26, and this may be a subtle point that he's making, but I think it is a point. You believe that there's a resurrection. That's good. I am the resurrection. It's not enough, in other words, just to believe that there is a resurrection to occur someday. No, you need to believe that I am the resurrection. I am the life. And therefore, your faith need not be in something you believe is going to happen. Your faith is supposed to be in me. I am the cause of all this. I am the reason that there is a resurrection. I am the reason that there is life. And so if you will believe in me, you'll never die. Or if you do die, you'll live again. Again, those two aspects of life and death. Physical death resulting in life. Spiritual life, which death cannot conquer. Do you believe this? Again, there's a little bit of a difference there. I believe my brother's going to rise again in the resurrection. Jesus said, I want you to believe that I and the resurrection. I am the life. Now, she would have seemed to respond in some faith, though. I mean, again, we're going to see in verse 39, she still does not fully grasp all that's meant by Jesus being the resurrection and the life. You know, she's going to be the one that protests when Jesus says, remove the stone. Oh, he's been dead for 4 days. There's going to be a stench. But she does respond, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world. There is some faith there. But Martha is going to struggle through this text in understanding the full weight and importance of Jesus' words in verses 25 and 26. What it really means for him to be the resurrection and the life. Now, just one other note. Because John will mention in this chapter two times that it's been 4 days that Lazarus is in the tomb. There are writings found in the rabbinical literature, not exactly to the date of Jesus' time, but that there was some belief among the Jews that for 3 days a soul would hover over a body. And then after 3 days, a soul would leave. I have no idea if that was any kind of popular thinking at this time, and that's why 4 days are mentioned. It is something that's brought up in later writings of the Jews, so I just throw that out there for that. Whatever you want to do with it. Any questions on Martha? Okay. Mary. Mary is told the teacher's looking for you. So Mary goes out. Does Mary go out by herself? No. There are those who take notes. And there are some who believe that given that there are Jews who have come to Bethany from Jerusalem, that speaks to the importance of this family. Mary is going to reappear in chapter 12, and she's going to be using this very costly ointment, this very costly perfume to anoint Jesus, which would also speak to the well-being and the high standing of the family. So it may be that Mary, Martha, and Lazarus are in very high standing in the town of Bethany, so high that even Jews from Jerusalem would go to be there for this period of mourning. And so Mary goes out to Jesus, and there are those who take note, and they go with her. And Mary goes out, and she has that same statement of faith. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. Okay. Jesus, in verse 33, saw her weeping, and the Jews came with her also weeping. And he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled, and said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Now, besides that being most of our favorite memory verse as a child, what's the importance of that short verse? How have you heard it? The compassion that Jesus had, and I do not doubt. Okay, showing his humanity. Again, that's something that Scripture would attest to time and again. And both of those may have had a part in this. It's not often that I appeal to the New Living Translation as being perhaps a little closer to the mark than the New American Standard, because that's generally not the case. When you look at this phrase in verse 33, and it's also found again in verse 38, of Jesus being deeply moved. In Greek literature, that is usually used to connote anger. We read it in our translations in John 11, and it's like, oh, he's really touched. The New Living Translation, let me find this here in my notes, which I think kind of gives a little better reading here. When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. Now, I'm telling you, I think that's closer to the original meaning than what the New American Standard reads. If that's the case, why is Jesus angry? Nobody believes. Nobody believes he can do anything about this. His disciples have not believed. Martha has not believed. Mary has not believed. All the Jews who are there wailing with her, they don't believe that anything can happen. This is just a picture of despair, and yet here is life coming to their midst, and they don't believe anything's going to change. And so Jesus wept is not simply, yes, he's sympathetic to their cause. He's a human just like they are. Jesus weeps. He is grieved over the lack of faith in what he can do. That's my take on it anyway. If you take great comfort in this being Jesus being sympathetic to us, that is true as well. That's found in Scripture. But in this case, I think it has more to do with this problem of unbelief in the presence of the very Son of God. Anybody want to comment on that one? Question? Yeah, Anna. Yeah, I mean, you look in the other gospel accounts, and there are, you know, Jesus approaching Nain, and out from Nain is coming this funeral procession, and it's a widow, and it's her only son, and he's dead, and Jesus goes and he touches, you know, the body and raises them back to life. You know, so this is not the first resurrection that Jesus, so I don't fully know that, other than, you know, in the context of John, what Jesus has been trying to hammer home throughout this book is life, life, life. I am life. I am life. I am the bread of life. I am the water of life. I give life abundantly. And now I'm telling you, I'm the resurrection and the life. I have life. And yet in the presence of death, nobody thinks Jesus can do anything about it. So I think under those circumstances, that would explain Jesus' mood in this case. Don? Yeah. He's deeply moved or troubled or angered within. And then verse 40, verse 39, Martha has again expressed some doubt and unbelief. And Jesus saying, I told you you'd see the glory of God if you would believe. Michael? Yeah, and you know, you look at Jesus' ministry, you know, you look at the other gospel accounts, and Jesus will, at the end of his ministry, you know, launch a verbal tirade almost against the Pharisees. Well, he didn't do that at the beginning of the ministry. He did that at the end, though. You know, after all of this opposition from them, after all their hardness of heart, then Jesus at the end just launches into, woe unto the Pharisees for this, this, and this. He's been very patient with his disciples throughout his ministry. And yet now, as we come again to the close of his ministry, and there's still this failure to understand, failure to appreciate who Jesus is, trouble within, weeping even, based on that. That's the take I'm going with anyway. Yes, Brother Bob? Yeah. I typically groan at my sons whenever I'm angry with them. No. Yeah. I've also seen, you know, a literal rendering of that when it comes to not humans, but, you know, for a horse snorting. You know, it's got some interesting connotations there. That's how I read it, Mike.
Whatever his emotional state, whether it was anger, whether it was sadness, they interpreted it, verse 36,
true,
as being one way.
Yep.
And in verse 38, it very plainly uses a completely different word there for being deeply moved within than the wept part. They are two different words. And that one absolutely is. In fact, one of the translations of that word is to snort. So literally, seems as if, I don't know, maybe if it wasn't, maybe it went from sadness to frustration to anger.
But you look at verse 37, and you know that, it all depends on the kind of the inflection you're using when you read it, that verse in itself demonstrates a lack of understanding. You know, if he had been here, he could have done something. Well, he is here. He can still do something. There's no understanding of that, though. And then right after that, again, deeply moved, or whatever your translation is.
No doubt, frustration at the end was an absolute. Yeah. They could not believe that they still didn't. But if you look back in John, the first chapter, verse 4, the light came into the world and men didn't comprehend.
Yeah.
And even when you look at the apostles at the end of his ministry, they still don't comprehend.
Right.
I mean, he's been with these people for 3 years, and they still don't get it.
Yeah.
That's got to be frustrating.
Yeah. Mitzi? No, and I agree. And I, you know, when we read this, Jesus wept, and we look at that from the standpoint of Jesus' compassion, Jesus' empathy, Even though I'm saying that within the context of John 11, it may point to something different, those things are still true. Jesus being empathetic, Jesus being sympathetic to us are still truths of Scripture. But in the context of John 11, it's all about what do you believe about Jesus? Is he the resurrection and the life? And he's confronting doubt after doubt after doubt. Now, I want to make sure we have time for the good stuff. So, I forgot I had that on the screen. So, Jesus proves his mastery over death. And he does so in a very emphatic way. First of all, he prays to God. And he does this, even the express purpose, you know, so that others will believe in him. And then you take that back to John chapter 5 and Jesus talking about how he and his Father, they act as one. And what one does, the other does. And if the Father gives life to the dead, then the Son also has life in himself. Well, now Jesus is praying to the Father, and he's about to do that very thing. And then he says, Lazarus, come forth. You remember what he said in John 5, 28 and 29? How is it that the dead are going to come forth from the grave? They're going to hear my voice. There's an interesting point that commentators have made over the centuries that if Jesus had not put the Lazarus on the beginning, then all the dead in that graveyard would have come forth. I don't know if that's the case or not. But he calls Lazarus by name. Lazarus, you come forth. And so he shows, I have power over death. And if he has power over death, then this sign is what means that everything he said in verses 25 and 26 is also true. He who believes in me will live, even if he dies. And he who believes in me will never die. Jesus' mastery over death means those things are true. Now there's another interesting point here as well. When Lazarus comes forth from the grave, what kind of condition is he in? It's bound, head and foot, and, you know, this. Don't think of a mummification. The Jews used loose wrappings, but they would bind the arms to the torso, and they may have bound the ankles together, so they're those who, you know, kind of picture Lazarus kind of hopping out of the tomb. I don't know that. But whatever the case is, he has to be helped to have all these wrappings taken off. When Jesus is raised in John 20 and verse 7, what about his wrappings? They're just folded up neatly and right there. Was Lazarus raised in the same way as Jesus? Lazarus was raised to physical life again. According to Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, what is Jesus the resurrection? What is he the first of? It's this new spiritual resurrection. He's still a body. He had a body. That body, though, you read the gospel accounts, that body was just appearing in rooms. You know? Just, whoa, there he is. He appeared right there. It still had the markings of the crucifixion on it, but it was a body that was going to be glorified up into heaven. So Jesus' resurrection is not going to be the same as Lazarus' resurrection. This is the resurrection of the body. But it's a body that's going to be changed, or is changed, you might say, even. So that kind of takes us through verse 44. Any questions through verse 44? All right. Let me make this last point, and then if you have any questions on the text at all, feel free to bring those up. There's one other thing that's really interesting here. Jesus' mission to give life brings about his own death. How does the chapter conclude? You know, there are Jews who were there. There are some who believe in Jesus, and yet there are others who go back and they report these things to the Pharisees. So the Pharisees, they gather this council together, and Caiaphas, who's the high priest, he even says he prophesied. Well, this is not the words of God pouring forth from his mouth. Caiaphas, in a very petty, power-driven kind of a way, is talking about, you know, it's necessary that one man die for the nation. They don't want the Romans coming in because there's been an insurrection and put it down and removing the Jews from power. So it's necessary that Jesus dies so that we remain in power and so that our nation remains. And John, you know, looking at this says, and this is exactly what happens. Jesus does die for the nation, not for national Israel, but for the people of God. And not only the Jews, but all those people who would be brought to God. But anyway, Caiaphas has said it's necessary that Jesus die. And so it says in verse 53 that from that moment they began plotting or planning how they might seize him. Give me 1 second, Don. I haven't made the point yet. All right, so I'm getting there now. All right. Oh, went dark. There we go. So they ring that bell and I get nervous. All right. You read this in John. Hostility has been increasing and increasing. And you read that in several places. Chapter 11 opens. The disciples are reluctant to travel to Jerusalem because they think we go there, we're going to die. And the chapter ends with the Jewish council agreeing to kill Jesus. Jesus went on a mission to bring life, and it hastened his death. Jesus came into the world on a mission to bring life, and it brought about his death. Now, Brother Don.
I've always looked at that verse 48, 49, 48. The way I've always looked at it is the Pharisees and the high priests saw Jesus as a threat to their way of life, to their very livelihood.
Mm-hmm. No doubt the popularity of Jesus was something they were aware of and worried about. By this time, his popularity had waned some. We saw that in chapter 6. I think, though, the point's there. If Jesus whips up this messianic fervor, how are the Romans going to respond to that? Well, they're going to come in with force. And if they come in with force, the Pharisees and the chief priests and the high priests, they lose it all. They lost the power. Now, the text concludes. Let me just show you again where we're going here. So Jesus leaves Jerusalem and he travels up to Ephraim about 12 miles away. Chapter concludes, the Passover of the Jews has arrived. We're a few days before. And so this is the final Passover. You're only in John chapter 11, but now the events really slow down. We're in that, getting close to that final week. In fact, Jesus is going to make his triumphant entry into Jerusalem in the 12th chapter. So Jesus is 12 miles away. He's very close to the city where he's going to die. There's expectation as the Jews have come to purify themselves before the Passover. There's all these questions about if Jesus is going to appear. But there's also, in the last verse of the chapter, let it be known, there's awareness. The chief priests have made it known. If you know where Jesus is, you see Jesus, you let us know. We want to apprehend him. So there's all this expectation. Is Jesus going to come? And if he comes, what's that going to mean for the high priest and their showdown with him? Is Jesus, you know, is he going to be a criminal? Is he going to be a hero? Is he going to be a king? All these things are up in the air. And that's John 11. All right, we're going to cover John chapter 12. Was there questions over here? Okay. John chapter 12 on Sunday, and I appreciate everybody's kind attention tonight.
Good evening. We all have desires in life, dreams, hopes, goals, and maybe an idea about our future. And we often put so much time and energy into making these things a reality. But if you haven't figured this out already, we don't always get what we want in life. We have a path that makes sense to us, and when things don't go our way, we get so upset. Jonah was a man that God called on to go to a wicked city and to teach him about the Lord. And from the moment he was called on, he fought God on his decision. The first thing he did was flee all the way to Tarshish, which is in the complete opposite direction of where he was supposed to go. After God sent a big fish to swallow him up and put him back on the path where he was supposed to go, he went to the city and he preached, and they heard the word. And Jonah was still upset with this. He didn't like the compassion that God showed on the people. And when Jonah left the city, God caused a plant to grow up and to give him shade. And when it vanished overnight, he got so upset that to the point where he wanted to die. Yes, he wanted to die because the plant he used for shade vanished. Jonah got to a point where he cried out, "Death is better to me than life." From the beginning, God had a plan for Jonah that would work out just fine. But Jonah fought God every step of the way. He didn't trust him and never understood his reasoning. He didn't understand why God would forgive these wicked people. But don't sometimes in our lives we do the same exact thing? We have an idea of what is best for us, and we fight God when things don't go our way. And it's hard sometimes to trust in God when we don't understand our future, and when things are certain things are happening in our lives. There'll be trials in our lives, and there'll be problems, and we might have no idea why these things are happening. And maybe years later we'll look back and see that God was shaping us to become a better person. Or he is teaching us some valuable lesson. Or maybe we'll never see it. Either way, God is always there in our lives guiding us, and we need to trust him. In Proverbs chapter 3 and in verse 5, it says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. Do not be wise in your eyes, fear the Lord, and turn away from evil." We don't have to figure out everything in our lives. We don't need to understand everything. But what we need to do is trust that as long as we stand with God, he will stand by us. And in these rough times that we face, we need to make sure that we don't turn to sin and forget about God. We need to get closer to him, continually pray, and strive to be the best Christians that we can be. There are so many other stories in the Bible of people like Jonah, of people who lack faith and trust in God. But there's also so many other stories of people who showed tremendous faith. Like Abraham, when he was called on by God, he was willing to sacrifice his only son for him. Whether the people trusted in God or not, he always delivered his people. So what are our attitudes going to be like? Are we going to complain and turn away from God when trials come our way, or are we going to put our trust and faith in him? So tonight, if you've been struggling lately and are in need of prayers or assistance, or maybe you want to make that decision to put your trust in God, whatever it will be, please let it be known while together we stand and sing.